As GenAI reshapes industries, understanding and leveraging its capabilities is no longer an option, it's a necessity. And that's exactly why at Hatchworks, we developed our GenAI Innovation Workshop. In this workshop, we immerse you into a full day of learning, hands-on ideation, and building. We hit foundational concepts and show you how they relate to your domain. Then we develop actual use cases for your business and your industry. And we even build a custom GPT based on the use cases we define. Check out the link in the show notes or visit Hatchworks.com to get started today. Welcome to Built Right, a podcast by Hatchworks where we help you learn how to build the right digital product the right way. In this season, we're going all in on generative AI with guests ranging from international AI speakers, founders of GenAI products, experts in specific domains of GenAI, and leaders across industries. We're here to help you figure out how to take advantage of this new emerging technology so you can win in the market. So whether you're an AI techie or just AI curious, we got you covered. Let's get into it. Welcome, Built Right listeners. If you're interested in hearing an AI founder story in the making from the previous chief strategy officer of Salesforce Innovations, this episode's for you. Catherine Von Jahn, affectionately known as KVJ, is the founder of Tough Day. And we're going to get into more of what that is in a second. But she's an experienced innovator, thought leader on the future of work using technology, which obviously AI is going to be a big part of that. But she's looking to solve some of our biggest challenges at work today. And before Tough Day, KVJ led Salesforce Innovations as Chief Strategy Officer. She's an advocate for workers, teams, and trust, as well as a recognized leader in technology. And she's been shared by CNBC, Forbes, Fortune, MSNBC, Wall Street Journal, and Wired Magazine, which is awesome. And I'm just so excited for this discussion today. KVJ, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm really excited for this. But today, we're going to get into your story of creating an AI startup. And I call it an AI startup, but really, that's just like the enabling technology for what I believe is something very human that you have a vision of building. And then we're going to dig into how, you know, human connection and relationships with AI is evolving. Plus, you're a strategy person. I'm a strategy person, so I'm sure we'll get into some of the fun strategic stuff around starting a company and what you think about and how that's changing with Gen AI. But first, like, I want to start with that founder story. And typically when we have a founder on, they're talking about their journey that already happened. What's so cool about this is like, you're in the midst of this thing right now. So we're getting it hot off the presses right as you're thinking about it. But start with like the why behind Tough Day, the vision there of what you're looking to build.
Oh gosh. Well, first, my story goes way back before building Tough Day and even before I started working. So I think I was always kind of destined to work on this issue, and I could share more about why and how, but really what we're trying to do is support workers through their difficult challenges, navigating, you know, complexity and perplexing situations. We want to help give workers the clarity that they need, the expert guidance and objective guidance that they need to succeed and thrive in the workplace.
And so much of that, it's evolving today, not to mention, you know, we've all kind of, a lot of us have moved to remote or some kind of mix of remote. And then, oh, by the way, you inject everything that's happened with Gen AI since 2022. So it's changing things like dynamically, plus just, you know, being an employee nowadays anyways is just tough. There's so much stuff to weed through, right?
It's hard. I think, I mean, listen, there are societal issues. There's like, there's so much going on for workers today. There's so much frustration and fear and grievance and confusion. I don't know that's all about the latest sort of exogenous forces and their impact. I think that a lot of that has been, you know, creeping up on us for many decades. And I would say like my first experience kind of having that record screeching moment of like, hey, wait a minute, what is going on here was way back in high school, actually, when I guess up until that point, I had never felt like I wasn't accepted or capable or, you know, a leader in the classroom or amongst my peers. valued. And I was leading the, I mean, this is kind of an aside, but like I was leading this Latin club as president. So my friend Julie and I, we got to high school and we just loved Latin. It's probably a little dorky, but we did. And we were like, we're going to make Latin cool. And we really did. We poured our hearts and passion into reviving this Latin club. And at some point we had hundreds of members. And
oh, wow.
There was a big induction that was about to happen. And we were, you know, inducting all the new members. And my Latin teacher told me that I could not perform the ceremony because I was a girl. And that,
oh, you're kidding.
No. And because traditionally Julius Caesar would have done it, and he had, you know, he had control and power. And so therefore we need to find a man in the group, a young man in the, you know, in high school to lead this ceremony. And I was just like, wait, what? This is crazy. But I was like, I don't know. I mean, that's just weird. And I went home and I told my mom, and my mom as a school teacher and fierce advocate for women, like, it's like, oh, hell no. Like, that's not how this works. And there's something called Title IX. And like, let's go in and talk to the school about it. And sure enough, I got to be Julius Caesar and lead the ceremony and all of that. But I think even, you know, so there are things that people just do and they think it makes sense to them, and they're in a powerful position to make decisions that, you know, unchallenged, that just frustrates people. It could have like totally diminished my educational experience, but I had an advocate. I had someone with knowledge and wisdom to say, hey, let's go have a conversation. Let's talk this out. And we resolved it. And I had a great relationship with my Latin teacher after that. And it all worked out. But that advocacy and that clarity and that understanding of like, hey, this isn't quite right and we can fix it. Like, that's really what we're trying to do for workers every day. Everyone should have a place to go to get that kind of clarity and advocacy. I mean, not that we're not coming in and helping. We're not going to send in my mom or anyone else into the organization. But the reality is, like, workers just need the information and guidance about what to do. And then they can go back to their organization and have conversations that might be hard for them. And that's, you know, that's why we're here.
Yeah, we need to replicate your mom as an AI to go in the system. But it's I always find that interesting when I talk to a leader or founder. There's always those like little kernels from their life that manifest later on and drive this for you. Because I mean, most students probably just would have said, okay, and just kind of kept that in and not known where to go. Like, thankfully you did have your mom you could go to that kind of led you through that, right? And yeah, really interesting. Yeah, good.
I would say like for most workers, if you kind of flash forward, and there's a lot in between, but if you flash forward, there are a lot of workers when something happens, to your point, they don't know where to turn. They don't have a family member who knows anything about management or coaching or HR or employment law. By the way, like, most things are not illegal. Like a lot of people might think like, oh, they're not allowed to do that. Yeah, actually, like, a lot of things are allowed. You're just kind of upset about the situation. So let's understand what's really going on and how we can fix it. And if you only have inexperienced and like lovely human friends that you can turn to, they're mostly going to support you. That's what humans do for each other in terms of like, oh, I'm so sorry that's happening. And yeah, he or she must be horrible. And let me give you a hug and sort of coddle you and like talk it out with you. And that kind of perpetuates the problem where... Mm. What workers really need is more clarity, more insight, and kind of, I mean, I would call it tough love, like objective advice, like in order to solve the problem, not to recreationally vent about it and kind of have that cathartic moment of like release. It's more meaningful in that, like, hey, let's talk about how you can go back and have a great conversation and resolve the situation before it turns into something massively frustrating and brings your coworkers down, distracts you from performance and all, you know, and becomes a mess.
Yeah, it's, I think on the manager side too, like I know I've run into this where I don't always know where to point somebody either, right? And having that kind of neutral third party in a sense, and we'll get into how this is actually the strategy behind how it works in a bit, but there's value in that to where it is somebody that is kind of, you know, outside of the nuance of the situation, right?
Well, yeah, I think just the point about managers, like managers are employees too, and managers mm-hmm. need support too. And yeah. and often they can't find the information or don't have the source of truth handy, and they can be ill-informed. So like this is just as much for managers as it is for employees.
So what was this inflection point for you? You know, you're at Salesforce, this awesome position and role. What's that inflection point where, okay, I'm going to take this, you know, kernel of an idea, purpose and vision that I have and turn it into something. What was that trigger for you? Was it inflection point of things going on in the AI space and now this is possible, or was it just the right time and just, you know, kind of organically went from there?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. So one, for better or worse, I've been around long enough in the tech industry. I've seen some things. So like, yeah. you know, and what I mean by that is like at the beginning of the internet boom, you know, I was at Lotus, you know, before we were acquired by IBM, but like sort of at the forefront of using the internet mm-hmm. to do business. And then in mobile was kind of out in front, pioneering new mobile solutions when that happened, and then moving into social and peer-to-peer and you know, all these different technological waves. When AI sort of started to enter the scene 10 years ago is when I got really curious about it. Like, wow, this can really enable so many human experiences, so much wisdom, knowledge sharing, expertise. We can really support people. The second thing was then like using this next wave of technology around AI to go advance those things. So, you know, I left and started playing and putting little teams together and building little prototypes. And what happened in that process was I was getting tons of phone calls last summer from friends across the industry, people I had worked with, people I had mentored, people who mentored me, and people were distressed and struggling with layoffs, struggling with like, well, how is AI going to change things, and worried about things. And I found myself kind of enjoying this process of talking people through like how they might think about it. And then I kind of realized like, duh, like this should be AI. We should like, it's
that's
not
the
about
thing.
Me and my advice. Actually, it's about the wisdom of the best managers on the planet, the best mentors on the planet, the best HR professionals, legal minds, all of that wisdom brought to bear at scale to help workers in a safe way, in a safe place, to empower them to go solve their own problems. Like that's kind of, that was the aha. And then I can tell you about what happened after that.
Yeah. So it's interesting too. You mentioned doing stuff 2016 and before. And a lot of people think this is like this new thing that just exploded on the scene, but it's been around for a while. I think 2017 was that big inflection point where the transformer architecture that really just accelerated this stuff took off, but it's been around for a while. But I think the interesting point, I mean, we chatted previous leading up to this, you mentioned how you were doing several different things, had some teams building POCs, but then this like moment of clarity to create focus and how important that was in kind of getting things moving.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that happened as well is a friend turned me on to the book Essentialism. I don't know if you've heard it or if we talked
about it. Yeah, I've checked it out since we talked. Yeah.
I mean, it was just so easy. Like, you know, probably there are other books written about this. It was like there was a moment in this book that basically was about like, you've got your glass of water. Like you can pour that into several glasses, or, you know, like sort of how are you going to spend your energy? On lots of little things or on one big thing? And then I was like, yes, like I have to do the thing that I care about the most, that the world definitely needs. And like, I knew I had to go explore it, and I knew I had the passion for it. And another friend said something to me like, okay, you were at Salesforce almost 10 years. Like, is this problem something you want to spend the next 10 years thinking about? And it was like,
yeah,
hell yes. Like, absolutely. Like, we have to make progress. We've been talking long enough. Like, we have to make progress on this. So,
yeah. And yeah, I think what's cool too is it's the beauty of using this new technology and AI for solving big problems, for doing good things. Because, you know, the way I think about it, there's the debate of, is it good or bad? And I think it's nuanced. Like, it's both, right? There's going to be good actors and there's going to be bad actors. And with this big of a disruption, it just means the scale is going to be that big on both sides of it. So there's a lot of value in, you know, people like you actually doing something valuable, important with the technology. But so you're a strategy person. Take me through the beginning days. I love hearing how founders think about things strategically in terms of, you know, you've got it nailed in terms of, okay, I have my purpose. I got the problem I want to solve. But what are other pieces? And some of this is probably like happening right now in terms of how you're thinking about it strategically, go to market, you know, what customers you're talking to, how you're refining the early thing that will be the product. Take me through some of that.
Yeah. I mean, one thing is just, and I think all founders kind of have this, is like, there's a point when you realize all your experience kind of was leading you here and you didn't know it all the way, you know, all along. And you have some secrets, some wisdom or experience that is like, hey, the world should know this. And I'm not going to write a book. I don't want to write a book. I want to build something and make an impact. So I think that was part one. Part two, or, you know, that was important and necessary. Then the strategic part of like, well, how are we going to do it? Like, we need to start somewhere. So I wanted to first validate the idea. Like, I talked to I really talked to a lot of friends who knew me very well. I talked to people in the industry working in tech, people who were CMOs and CROs and CHROs and VCs and lawyers. And, you know, it was kind of like circling lightly, like, here's what I'm thinking about. Like, hey, let's catch up, have coffee. I have something boiling here. They're like, I just want to talk about it. And people were like, oh my gosh, you have to do this. So like that, like, partly I was motivated, partly that was also like a lot of validation just anecdotally. And then I was like, okay, I'm getting serious now. Like, I'm going to need a team, and I need to think through this with some folks. So I asked a friend who's an executive at Google if he would sponsor a dinner. I was like, I think we need to bring some legal minds, HR minds, great management minds, coaching minds, you know, business minds together. And I just want to host a dinner and get them talking about a couple of the questions I have. And he said, and it's such a gift, he's like, you can't get anything done in a dinner. What are you talking about? And I was like, well, I need a way to like bring people together. And he was like, how about I fund an offsite? Like, do you think you could get 8 to 10 people to go spend 5 days in the Caribbean somewhere, and we just, you know, lock away and hack this? And I'm like, oh, like, I don't know. Like,
that sounds much better.
Like, it sounds awesome. Thank you very much. Like, it's an incredible opportunity. And it turns out both old friends and new ones, people I had met like a month before, were saying, I love this so much, and I believe in you, and I want to come down and be part of this offsite. And that's very humbling and special. And it was just this enormous sense of love and appreciation for these people. And we could have walked away from it saying like, this is a terrible idea and we should not do this. But, you know, with 3 weeks' notice, 10 people flew to the Dominican Republic and had 5 days kind of fun, of sharing, of dinners, of, you know, just being together, and, you know, one-on-one walks and meditation and yoga and work. And essentially we hacked the business plan, which I had been ruminating on, and I asked each person to do kind of a mini section on their area of expertise. So as an example, Jenny Fielding from Everywhere Ventures was there, and she did a session on how to think like a VC. And it was amazing. And not everyone in the room had the same kind of expertise that other people had. So everyone was learning. And then we would do sort of workshops around each piece of expertise. So in that case, we hacked our investor deck.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Strategically, it was not, it was like bringing in the right partners, I guess, thought partners to help think through where we go and how we get it done.
I have so many questions about the workshop. That would have been awesome to be a fly on the wall there. But like, for, to take a step back for all the listeners right now, look what KVJ did, right? She went and talked to customers first, and you always hear this, but so many folks go straight to building the thing. It's such a foundational piece, actually talking to folks, hearing their perspectives, and the right folks, right? The target folks you're kind of going after. But you mentioned you were talking to some friends. How do you avoid like the friend bias when you're pitching them a new idea and, you know, they want to tell you, oh, it's awesome, that's great. How do you avoid that? I guess talking to folks outside of your friend group as well, but.
I mean, first of all, I value candor, and I think all my friends kind of know, like, I'm going to tell them what I really think. And I also know my friends tell me what they really think. Like, I've had ideas where people are like, you're crazy. Like, that's never going to work. You know, so I think just seeking diverse opinions and having diverse friends give you a point of view on like what they're thinking. Like, there was no way I could circulate with that, like, let's say 20, 30 people and have them come back. So like in circulating with all those different friends, like it could have been that one or two of them might have been placating me or coddling me or like, that's sweet, KVJ. But no, I feel like they, fortunately, I have friends that will tell me the truth.
Those are good friends. So, you know, you're starting this startup. I'm curious with folks now, with everything going on with Gen AI, you have Sam Altman talking about, oh, there's going to be one person, $1 billion companies. Are you approaching anything differently as you're thinking about your team structure, how you're using technology in the building of it, that may be different now than how you would have done it, say, you know, 5 years ago? Is there anything different in your approach early on?
Well, I had a startup before Salesforce, so it's an interesting thing to reflect on. I think it was doing things back then that actually now are acceptable and back then were not. An example, using contractors all over the world, like, you know, it used to be that VCs would say, what, you don't have a core team like sitting together, living and working together? And now, like, that's not a question anymore. In fact, they're like, oh, yeah, like you should just get the best talent wherever they are. So we can't afford to hire people full time, but fortunately a lot of people are passionate about it and they want to work on it even as contractors. So, that's one piece. I think, AI first mindset. So, you know, AI is not perfect, but you can kind of think of it as the first pancake in almost anything. Like, could I do? And it might be messy and it might not work exactly right, but you could probably expedite the process a little bit by thinking about using AI first.
The first pancake. I like that. And I've not heard that analogy. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think like using AI every day, we can get into like the research techniques that we're using, because I think some of those are really new.
Yeah, I do want to get into that. But just quick aside, you just gave like the perfect pitch for Hatchworks right there. So like a big part of our operations is down in Latin America. And it's so true. Like there is talent everywhere. What we found interesting is like post-pandemic, people were remote. the real important thing was, can you share the day's work? Can you be in the same time zone? But I just love how that mindset is progressing. It doesn't just have to be somebody co-located in the U.S. I mean, there's so much good talent everywhere. But yeah, let's get into that. You talked about some of the research techniques and how you're approaching this that may have been different pre everything going on with generative AI.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I should also say, like, I'm a co-founder. I have an amazing CTO who was at that Dominican Republic offsite and then, you know, fell in love with it too and decided to join me on this journey, as well as another one of our colleagues who joined. So there are three of us as a core team. And I would say we're all inventing the research methodologies all the time and kind of, you know, each of us has our own experience to inform that. I think, you know, we've all had some product management, some sales, some customer facing roles, strategy roles, all of those things. So we're all kind of ambidextrous, with each one of us having sort of a core. You know, like Alberto is deep tech, right? And I cannot code, at least not anymore. So I think in terms of interesting research methodologies, I mean, first I should say, lots of the old methodologies still work. Like our employee need survey has been illuminating, and I could get into that. But, you know, so don't overwhelm yourself with designing the biggest kind of research project. Like some of the old tools are still really, really good. So we use those as well. I think the Wizard of Oz testing that we did as a methodology was phenomenally insightful. And just to explain what that is, and I think probably, you know, different organizations do this and call it something else, but what we mean by Wizard of Oz testing is that users come in to engage with AI, but rather than having AI answer the questions, we've got our wizards behind the curtain answering as if they were the AI. So we would schedule user testers to come in. You know, we used just a Google Meet, and we said, look, we're going to turn off the video and turn off the voice, and you're only going to be texting with the AI. And we told them it's not really an AI, but like we're simulating that experience. And we were actually removing PII and using AI to see what would it say. But we also had a lawyer, a manager, a coach, an HR professional sitting around the table. So when a question would come in, kind of depending on the first five lines of the exchange, we would decide who's going to be the protagonist in play the AI and like actually be the one to type. And then the others are all going to discuss and give ideas, like, so we could move fast. So we were, one of us was representing the actual AI and saying, this is what Quad, Pi, whatever, any other AI would say, ChatGPT, we used all of them about this topic. And then we also had just the humans answering. And the exchanges were amazing. I think a couple things that surprised us. One was everyone, 100% of people were very quickly engaged, sharing problems and sharing a lot of multidimensional problems. Like they'd kind of start simple and then get into a lot of complexity. They seem to do that much faster than you would do it with a human. Like if we're sitting here talking, there's going to be some time for us to get to know each other, for me to trust you and you to, you know, to know I can share things without feeling judged or feeling any shame about what I'm going to say. And I think a lot of that gets removed when a human is talking or chatting with AI. It's just like very matter of fact.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So it was like, and then we thought the sessions would last about 15 minutes, like come in, ask your question or two and you're out. And 100% of the people went at least 30 minutes.
Wow.
That was astounding. And we actually had to like cut people off because we're like, we have another one scheduled. And people were asking if they could schedule another user testing session so they could come back in. And so that was
because they enjoyed it that much.
Yeah, they enjoyed it. But even being unprompted, just spontaneously, they would say things in the chat about, you know, this is really helpful. I'm going to try that. Like there was like 100% of people said that they got value out of this and something that they can go try. So that was also great to understand. And then, of course, again, removing all PII from those transcripts, we can use those exchanges to fine-tune our model. So the real human dialogues really help to train the AI to be curious, to understand. I mean, we're training. We know that you can't necessarily give someone the right answer without having context. So, you know, similar to if you went to a lawyer or a coach or manager and you said, I have a problem, they'll probably ask you 3 to 5 questions about what's going on before they give you advice. So the same has got to be true of an AI that's going to support you in these challenges.
Yeah, it's such a smart approach. And the concept of Wizard of Oz testing, it's been around for a while, but there's the new element here, just from hearing you talk about it, you get to see how people are interacting with the simulated AI, which gives you an idea of the experience, how they would interact with it naturally with a human. But the genius part is you're using that to train the AI, train the LLM versus just saying, okay, we got off the shelf ChatGPT, go have fun. Right. And that's genius. It really is, like, especially because this is all kind of new and emerging. So if you're starting an AI kind of focused company, like such a great approach there for listeners when they're thinking about it. And you mentioned you tried Claude and, you know, ChatGPT and some different ones. What was that process like of like deciding on an LLM? Did you look at open source options? Yeah. What was that like? And I know you're not the technical founder, like
technical,
you mentioned.
But... No, I think that there was, gosh, I'm even thinking back to like December, like everything changes so fast, but I remember when we first, you know, we were playing with Pi and it just felt so much friendlier and empathetic. And we were just literally asking questions of all the platforms to see like what resonates with us, what kind of brand experience do we want to have or user experience do we want to have? And, you know, we can learn from how they're delivering that. And then we could also learn where each of them fell short. I mean, obviously, we're not going to build our own LLM. We are going to fine tune based on the area of expertise where we're focused. And, you know, there are a couple private ones that we're working with now.
Yeah, and that's the beauty.
We're not looking to. I hate to say it this way, we're not looking to train ChatGPT or OpenAI's model to do what we're going to do, right? So we're building the layer on top.
And you don't need to now. That's the beauty of this shift that's happened. It's truly kind of democratized the ability to use AI. And that was the big blocker because, I mean, you look at ChatGPT and these models, they literally are spending, you know, up to millions, billions of dollars to train the models. And they're running for literally days on end to train it. And now that you have these options out there, the open source options, they were actually doing a webinar today, which when this airs, it'll be in the past, but looking at how to leverage open source models via Hugging Face to just build a simple RAG, retrieval augmentation generated chatbot. I'm sure you're familiar with that, but
sounds familiar.
Yeah, exactly. And that goes back to the context element, which is so critical. But I think the LLM component will become commoditized in a good way because it'll be available to everybody. And that's where proprietary data, what you're training it on top of it, and then the context element, that's where, back to strategy, that's where the differentiation comes in. That's where you can actually build a moat. And I kind of want to shift there, just back to the strategy side. I feel like the ability to build a moat just got a lot harder. You're seeing a lot of products out there that are just kind of wrappers on ChatGPT. ChatGPT comes out with new functionality and it wipes out a whole slew of products. Yep. So how do you think about moat building in this new age we're in?
Yeah, I think one part of it is about content. So, you know, content partnerships and, you know, licensing is hard in this space. It's like nobody's figured out that out exactly. It's not like we're, you know, Spotify and we can just, you know, there's a model for like breaking up the album into songs. There's, in this case, it's like dissecting a book or articles or what have you into like the soup. So it's just, it's harder to figure out how to do that. So, you know, we're thinking strategically about our partners in that space and doing POCs. I'm not sure, I can't really talk about who those partners are without their permission to do so. And it's a little early for that. But we're really excited about the organizations we're working with, leveraging their content because they believe in this idea as well. And we're kind of figuring out new ways to add value or exchange value with them. So it you know, doesn't necessarily have to be cash for, you know, each time a, you know, an article is referenced in terms of as a source in something. It's really, there's lots of other ways we can deliver value back to those publishers and authors and experts. So I think that's one part of the moat. I think there are some features that, to your point, like probably will become part of the broader LLM space, but I think in the short term, they can help us win. And for this use case, so like there are things that can help us win with this use case. And once we're in, then like, you know, if there's another place for that, if we're already the trusted source, then we're the trusted source and it's harder to pull you out. But I think go-to-market is the other piece, is like the go-to-market partnerships and our strategy for how we deliver this. It's not, I'll just say this, it's not the usual suspects. It's not the Accentures and the SIs, and like a lot of tech companies will, you know, we want to have relationships with those organizations, but we're not relying on them as our go-to-market. So we're being smart about who makes the most sense in this context to partner with us and be the face of our organization.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think all new business models are going to emerge from this. You mentioned, like, just the other day, I believe it was a partnership between Reddit and Google leveraging their data. And it's like, oh, well, here's this whole new revenue stream we have that we've just been building over time. So I think that's going to be a super interesting part in terms of how these business models get defined, how they evolve, because it's not, to your point, it is kind of messy. Like you mentioned, like the soup metaphor, it's like baking a cake. Well, it's all in the cake. So which piece am I, you know, divvying up?
Exactly.
But I want to go back to one point you mentioned earlier, and it gets to kind of the human connection side with AI. And you mentioned how people were interacting with the AI, even if it was simulated, was completely different. And I talked to a friend the other day. They said on their commute, they're using the ChatGPT function where you can talk to it. And they just talk to it on their commute. And I'm like, what are you talking to the AI for, you know, 30 minutes at a time? But it is a different interaction. Like, how do you see that evolving over time with that difference of interacting with AI versus, say, another human? And what happens there?
Well, I think it's important to recognize what the user in any of, you know, any of the use cases. So like what the user wants to get out of it. Like, is it entertainment? Is it comfort?
Yeah.
Is it something actionable? So I think AI can do all of the above. It's just about, you know, what design the experience for what your users really want and expect of you. So in our case, like we're toning down all the kind of cozy coddling kind of things.
Yeah.
Because we are hearing from our users that what they want is the thing that most of their, you know, friends and colleagues aren't giving them, which is a kind of a bit of tough love and saying like, hey, you might look at it this other way. And it's funny because I think managers can often give their employees a bit of that. And the employee might think, oh, I'm not really sure what their motivations are. I'm not, you know, I don't know. Yeah. Like, I better think about that. I'm not sure if that's right. And you're not going to open a book and read a book on management and figure that out, right? So like there's something in between that is like, actually, I want to go to a source of truth that can either validate what my manager said, or my manager can go there and say like, actually, this is a much better way to answer this question than I would have it. Like, I would have. But there seems to be a need for an outside source that is just totally objective and just can say, this is how I would break down the problem. Like, does it seem to be illegal, unethical, or just uncomfortable? Guess what? Like 99.9% of the time, it's just something uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And if you can acknowledge that it's uncomfortable, then we can talk about like, how do you fix that? And so I can also imagine a super friendly, cuddly teddy bear style AI that is really just there to like tell you how awesome you are. Like it just depends what you want, you know?
That's a different purpose, which may be, it may be a bad thing in the long run. I like the approach that you're taking where it is, you know, kind of the tough love, the getting to the real meat of the situation. But synthetic humans.
Yes.
Big pivot right here. It sounds scary, but we talked a little bit about this and another just really genius approach to starting something today. What are synthetic humans? How are you using them?
Yeah. So based on all the research that we've been doing, we've identified really 10 personas or archetypes. I guess, you know, I like the term archetype, but we've put some persona around the archetypes. So we know what the top challenges are that workers are facing most regularly. We also know the kind of the one-off use cases or the less common things, but we've built these, we've trained 10 personas, 10 AI to represent these different challenges or represent workers who have these challenges. And we've also designed them to represent different geographies, different underrepresented groups, like just putting more context into like who these individual personas are. And so imagine if you had a human come in and interact with the AI. In this case, we've got these AIs trained to represent an individual of a, you know, particular background with a particular lived experience with some particular problems at work that is asking us first like a whole bunch of questions. So our wizards can answer AI questions and get a lot more questions than what we would get from doing user testing. So complimentary. We also then moved on to have these personas asking AI directly a bunch of questions. So, it's gotten really interesting. I would say 50% of the questions that these synthetic workers are asking are brilliant, are really insightful, really interesting. And 50% are just like, gobbledygook, or not that, just they're not interesting. They don't help us understand a problem that we want to solve. And so we're consolidating all the best questions from each of these personas back into the themes where we need to become experts. And then we're able to use that to kind of direct what content we need to be able to fine tune the AI to do, to have those conversations. And we've actually like really had some breakthrough with that. Like I'll just give you an example. We had a scenario about micromanagement, and you know, the questions weren't necessarily about micromanagement. They were about behaviors that the AI could tell relate to micromanagement, and then could make recommendations for how to deal with a manager who's a micromanager, and things you might ask about are ways to navigate that situation. And it was just like, wow, this is really cool. Like, it's really working.
I'm getting like chills thinking about this in a good way, not like because synthetic humans are a scary thing, but I go back to like back in the day, previous roles, we would define personas. They would live in a PowerPoint deck, and it's as far as they went, but you're actually like giving life to these personas, and not only giving life to them, but you're using them to further train and enhance, in this case, the LLM, which is the underlying, you know, machine of what you're building.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And so the synthetic human, which is an AI, is interacting with the LLM, the tool that you're using. So you have AI interacting with AI.
Yeah.
Was there any just like weird, like off the wall things you saw happen out of that? Or
I mean, sometimes it just got really repetitive. Like it kind of got in like these repetition loops.
Circular
where like they're not even having a conversation. My manager's a micromanager. Oh, it sounds like your manager's a micromanager. That kind of thing would happen. Like, but no, I mean, we're really cautious. We've had some outside guidance from AI researchers that have helped us to do this as well. So, I mean, we're trying to be very ethical about it. And, but in terms of weirdness, like I said, 50% of the questions and things that were coming out of that, we were just kind of like, let's scrap it. But the fact that 50% was good, it's not about like, oh, now our persona is great. Like, actually, what we just want to do is get more research. And if this, we have to still evaluate whether or not each exchange with this synthetic persona is worthy to learn from or not. And that's humans doing that. So
you have a whole new product idea right there. You could do synthetic humans, which I'm sure there may be companies already doing this, but you're building
one that I heard of doing this from market research where they've simulated.
It's cool.
To your point about personas in a PowerPoint, isn't it interesting though, like take them out of the PowerPoint and have them interact with you.
That's crazy. So the last thing I want to hit on, you mentioned earlier being at Lotus, you kind of saw the birth of the internet and all these transitions with mobile and cloud and things going on. Where do you sit where we're at, or where do you put where we're at right now with generative AI? At what scale? Is it at the scale of the internet, more or less?
Bigger.
Do you see like dot-com bubble hype? How would you equate it, having worked through that experience?
I mean, I feel like there were a lot of technologies that I thought were hype, like just personally, like crypto. I mean, I know people are huge crypto fans. I'm just like, and NFTs and stuff. Like, I mean, we all have our opinion, but this is going to transform our lives in ways that are just really hard to even imagine, because our work is going to change. Our relationships are going to change. I think we're going to have like bots doing all kinds of things for it, like bots negotiating with bots to do a lot of the work. I think problems will fix themselves. There will be, you know, your car is going to know it needs something. And just, you know, I think Tesla already does this, like just drive itself to the nearest gas station and get whatever you need, if gas stations still exist. But I think that this is transformative. This is a tidal wave. And I think you've got people who are sitting on the beach, looking at the weather, thinking it's a sunny day, and they see this wave out in the distance, and it's like, it's pretty. And then you have some people running for the hills. They're like, oh my gosh, like this is scary. And you have some people grabbing their surfboards and going out to like check it out. And those people on the surfboards are the ones who are going to define what this is. And I think that's a wake up call for everybody. Like, who do we want doing this work? And how and what solutions? And, you know, so I'm hoping that people really lean in. We need to democratize the innovation in this space and include all kinds of people in that really pioneering work that's going to inform how we live.
Yeah, I love the kind of surfing tidal wave analogy. And like at Hatchworks, we're doing exactly that. We do custom software development, but right now we're digging into every aspect of the software development lifecycle, from strategy design, development, testing, deployment, all of that. And we're seeing where we can leverage generative AI in that. But there's tools, but then there's this foundational change of how you interact. Like, we have architects now that are defining the skeleton of the architecture working with Gen AI. Then you get, you know, you're kind of taking it iteratively as you go. Getting the framing done. So you're not having to worry about like the syntax and all these like minutiae of things. You're focused on the broader thing and the more valuable work. But it's been really interesting digging in that with our engineers and architects.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I appreciate you being on the podcast. So I want to point folks to Tough Day. Where should they go? And you mentioned a survey as well. Is that something that's still running that people can go take? Like, where should we point people and how can they find you?
Yeah, tough.day, tough, like tough.day. And you'll find the survey. I'm assuming by the time this airs, it'll still be available for people to continue to share their point of view. And it, you know, we'll have more and more available on that. If you're interested in user testing, we're always looking for user testers as well. And there's a spot on the site where you can sign up for that.
Nice. We got to get Hatchworks using it as an early user there. But thank you, KBJ. This has been one of my favorite, like, nuanced discussions. So much great meat to. This is one that I'll go back and listen to again. But thanks for being on.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Built Right. If you enjoy the show, give us a follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to leave us a review. For more info on Built Right, visit us at hatchworksbuiltright.com.
Do you already have a Gen AI use case in mind for your business, but don't know where to get started? Hatchworks Gen AI Accelerator is exactly what you need. We guide you from ideation to a tangible prototype. Our approach provides a low-risk, high-value pathway for you to validate and test Gen AI technology on a small scale before committing to full production. We take you through technology and LLM selection, perform data preparation, and then build the actual prototype. And then we do testing and model fine-tuning of your prototype. The best part is, we get you to this prototype in just 2 to 8 weeks based on the scope of your use case. Check out the link in the show notes or visit hatchworks.com to get started today.